Chapter 11. Big Mac Attack. I would rather be ashes than dust. I would rather that my spark should burn out in a brilliant blaze than it should be stifled by dry rot. I would rather be a superb meteor, every atom of me in magnificent glow, than a sleepy and permanent planet. The proper function of man is to live, not exist. I shall not waste my days in trying to prolong them. I shall use my time. Jack London. After sharing the small estate for a few weeks with Lisa and Maggie, we develop comfortable routines that overlap once or twice a day while still affording plenty of space and privacy. They come down to the pool house at around 11 o'clock every morning for a swim and a glass of limonada and a half hour of lying in the sun on the loungers by the pool. It's very pleasant to have them around and doesn't interfere with my work. A late lunch is my main meal of the day, and I do the same thing every day. I lay out all the stuff I find in the fridge, starting with what I picked up at the stores and street markets that morning on my walk in town with Maya. I throw out whatever seems too old or unpopular and lay everything else out on the kitchenette's island counter. As the summer progresses and more people flow in and out through the course of the day, people will begin bringing in their own items, picked up at the stores, before visiting, so the whole thing becomes quite a community venture. It's nice to have a no-hassle, no-cooking, easy clean-up way to eat without it being too boring. It's also a nice way to be a reasonably good host without having to really do much. I make a few trips to this buffet throughout the day and have a fish taco or something light in town on my nightly walk with Maya and visit to Frank, and that takes care of my eating needs and hosting duties. I usually pick up a few items every day, something new or something to replace something we ran out of. Lisa got the hang of it from the beginning and started contributing to our stock. It's easy to get an idea of what's popular and what's not, but it's also nice to keep it interesting by introducing new things to see how they'll be received. Unpopular stuff naturally migrates to the back of the fridge or cabinets and gets thrown out once a week or so. Anyway, that's a big part of the daily routine down at the pool house where I work and where others come to visit or help or just to swim and eat and sunbathe. After a few weeks of this comfortable ritual, Lisa pulls up a chair at the side of my table where she usually sits for a few minutes of conversation every day. Today, she has an unusual request. Maggie wants to ask you if she can interview you, like Julie in the first book. I push back from my work and study Lisa to see if I heard her correctly. Maggie read Damnedest? I ask. She's read both of your books, more than once. She has the electronic versions on her laptop, so she read the extra material, too. She says you hate yodeling, love death, and you think the universe is a big, playful puppy. Is that right? The puppy thing is, I reply. I look at her over the tops of my reading glasses. Nothing about this sounds like a good idea offhand. She read the books because, she hesitates and continues, she overheard a fight between her father and me, and she got the idea that you were to blame. For the breakup of our home and family, I guess. I see, I say, but I really don't. I have to make a point, I tell her. And believe me, I'm very reluctant to say this. But the fact is that I cannot participate in human affairs. I'm sorry. I know how stupid that sounds, but that's really how it is. If you're suggesting that your daughter might benefit by spending time with me as part of some healing process, or to get her back on the right track or something, you've got the wrong idea. Nobody benefits from me. Not like that. No, that's not what I'm suggesting. I have no framework, not even the memory of a framework, within which to conduct any but the most mundane interpersonal dialogue. I don't even know the words anymore, or why one thing might be better than another. I would exude wrongness. I don't think you appreciate what a train wreck. That's not what I'm completely useless regarding. Jed! Yes? May I continue without being interrupted? I have to think about that. Yes? What if she stays away from personal matters? She could keep it clinical, impersonal. She could. I have no understanding. How possible or likely is that? It's both, if she has adult guidance. You? And her grandfather. Oh, I ponder. It's a setup. It's been discussed. And you and Frank would be what? Counseling her? Coaching her? We could help her come up with good questions and understand your answers. Review her notes with her. I don't think it would be like we were trying to dissect you or anything. I laugh at that. Dissecting is fine, I say. There's nothing about sharp blades I don't like. It's the dull ones I find annoying. Regardless, I can't agree now. Bring her by and we can all talk, and then we'll see. She frowns. I don't see why it should be so complicated, she says. I don't see that it is, I reply. The reason I can't agree is because it's not there yet. This thing hasn't come into focus or alignment. I'm aware of it. I'll watch it, and if it becomes clear that it should happen, then we'll go ahead with it. This is how my agreement with the universe about the third book works. The only reason I'm here and in contact with these people is the third book. If it weren't for the third book, there would be no question of being interrogated by a possibly angry or resentful young lady who is being coached by her in-crisis mom and somewhat lunatic grandfather. I wouldn't be meeting these people or answering any question more profound than debit or credit. Paper or plastic. This thing with the girl, Maggie, for instance. I have no personal interest in whether or not her project with me happens. It's not that I have the ability to care, but for some reason I don't. It's that I don't have the ability. I have no framework within which one outcome might be better or worse than another. What I do have, though, is this arrangement with the universe. I'll write the book if it lays out that way. That's the deal. The universe knows exactly what I mean by that, and so do I. I mean just what we see happening in this situation with Maggie. The pieces have to fall into place, and they can't need me to force or finesse or finagle them. It's not really an agreement any more than inhaling constitutes an agreement to exhale. It's simply a recognition, an acknowledgement. I am part of a process. It works the way it works. All I can say at this early stage is that it looks like the universe wants the third book because the pieces are falling unmistakably into place, and they have been. Every step of the way. It's all coming together, and I'm pretty sure the thing with Lisa's daughter will fall into place as well. It hasn't yet, though. It has not yet clicked into place, so we'll wait until it does or doesn't. Maybe it will, maybe it won't. I could mess it up by playing my part poorly. Saying yes to the girl before the yes became apparent to me would be incorrect and unpleasant. It would feel artificial, pushed, scared, and egoic. For example, not right. There will be a time to say yes, and things will proceed perfectly, flawlessly, elegantly, if they are allowed to do so. Lisa doesn't see why it should be so complicated because she doesn't see how simple it is. This isn't just the way I'm treating her and her daughter. This is the way I do everything. This is the way an integrated being maintains alignment and harmony with the universe, and how the effortless perfection that is plain to behold in every single aspect of non-egoic creation is enjoyed on the personal level as well. Through unconditional surrender, I have mastered the universe. By releasing all control, I am in perfect control. Controlling nothing, I control everything. Only by taking control could I lose control. I don't remember what it means to work, to toil, to do something unpleasant. I don't distinguish between work and non-work, weekday and weekend. I don't take holidays off or go on vacations. I probably spend, on average, 4 hours a day working, but I don't think of it as work any more than I think of walking the dog as play or shopping for lunch as a chore. The idea of doing something I don't feel like doing is almost absurd to me. If something needs doing, there will come a time when I feel like doing it. If that time doesn't come, it doesn't get done and didn't need doing. I have no schedules or appointments or set hours. I have no concept of duty, obligation, or responsibility. I have no affiliations or connections or ties. For Lisa, though, that's what life was. Schedules and obligations and responsibilities. An endless plate-spinning act. For her entire adult life, that's all she's been doing. Frantically keeping dozens of spinning plates balanced on sticks like an old vaudeville routine. Scurrying back and forth in a perpetual panic. Terrified that one might fall and smash. Adding more plates every year. Performing this manic, macabre dance, not for 5 minutes at a time, but every waking minute of every day for years on end with no end in sight. Unless she just stopped. Which is what she finally did. She was stuck between two unthinkable things. Keep spinning the plates and stop spinning the plates. But slowly, over 3 years, one of the unthinkable things became less unthinkable, and she did it. She stopped. And all the plates came crashing down and made a terrible mess, and now here she is, trying to figure out what, if anything, survives such a calamitous betrayal. Was that plate-spinning act who she was? Or just something she did? It's 2 months later now, and she still doesn't know. Not everyone has it so bad, of course, and probably very few feel like they're drowning in their own lives. Some people have it much worse than Lisa did, and some have it much better. But it's not quality of unconscious life that concerns us here, just unconsciousness, and that takes many forms. Manic plate spinning is just one of them. If I had to live one day from Lisa's old life, even a relatively easy day, or an easy day from her husband's life, for that matter, I would think myself accursed. Just getting together with buddies on Sunday afternoon to drink beer and watch a ball game would be a hellish torment. The high point of Dennis and Lisa's year, the vacation, seems to me an unbearable hardship. If I had to spend 5 minutes on a cruise ship, or in Las Vegas, or any place with people in mouse costumes, I'd seek escape as from a burning house. That people subject themselves to such ordeals willingly, for pleasure and at considerable expense, is completely outside my comprehension. As always, it's important to remember that it's not me personally we're talking about. These same things would be equally true for anyone in even a modestly developed state of adulthood. Or maybe it's a facet of one-pointedness, of being a task-specific person. And anyone who is focused entirely on one thing to the exclusion of all others would find all off-task activities equally insipid. Or maybe it's both. Maybe anyone in a state of developing adulthood will undergo a natural reduction in their interests from many to few, and even to one, as they come into alignment, as they clear the debris and uncover their true calling. Or maybe it's neither. Maybe I'm just becoming an old poop. I look at people's lives, and it never becomes less confounding to see the ways in which they squander the only true wealth they possess, despite not knowing when it will run out, only that it will, throwing minutes and hours and days away like hot coals. What else does it mean to be asleep than to dispose of our own lives so thoughtlessly? What could be a more definitive symptom of non-lucidity? Every minute we spend oblivious to the value of a minute is a minute of unconsciousness. This isn't some screwball scheme to latch onto the present moment in time. It's simply what it means to be awake. Lisa has spent much of her life entangled in the thorny underbrush of her life. I don't think she's unique in this regard. I think most people are so bound up by their false beliefs, so tightly wrapped up in their fictitious personas, that they have no knowledge whatsoever of what life really is or how it really works, of what they themselves really are, or of their rightful place in creation. Few people have any comprehension of what heaven and hell really are, that they're rotting away in the latter, never knowing that their birthright is the former. It may not seem like hell when we're in it, just regular life, but once we're out, as Lisa is just starting to discover, we see our previous condition as an insensible state of tormented writhing. Very few people seem to have even the slightest idea of what a living spirituality really is, what integration is, what wealth and power and beauty really are, the so-called experts least of all. Is all that heaven and hell business overstating it? It feels like it is, but whenever I make an effort to challenge my perceptions in this regard, I only manage to reaffirm and deepen them. Every once in a while, using libraries and bookstores and the internet, I seek out the best thinking, the most enlightened minds, the most lucid communicators of the loftiest subjects to find out what message they're putting out. At first, I start feeling a bit more optimistic about the spiritual state of humanity. But then the puniness comes through. That horrid self-centricity, which is the hardened steel and reinforced concrete of delusion. And I throw a grudging salute to Maya and remind myself not to look again. I emerge from my reverie. Lisa is staring at me expectantly, We are, I recall, discussing the idea of her daughter Maggie asking me some questions. If you want to know how I'll answer something, I tell her, ask me something. She thinks about it for a minute. Okay, she says through self-conscious laughter. If you had to be an ingredient on a Big Mac, which one would it be and why? I laugh too. That's your question? I ask. Where'd you get a question like that? A human resources manager asked me in an interview for an internship one summer. What did you answer? Let's not make this about me. I wait. It caught me off guard, she says, which was probably the point. I said I'd be the special sauce because it's bold yet mysterious. We both laugh at that. What's so mysterious about the special sauce? I ask. Isn't it a secret recipe or something? I don't know. I thought it was Thousand Island dressing. I don't know either. I'd never even ever eaten one. I just knew the ingredients from the commercials. Did you get the job? Internship. Yes, I got it. So, how would you answer if Maggie asked, which ingredient of a Big Mac would you be? Whichever one had the power to terminate its own existence. She stares at me, not sure if I'm joking. No, come on. What would you say if Maggie asked? Whichever one had the power to terminate its own existence. Seriously? I take a few seconds to see if I have any other answer to the question, but I don't. Reckon so. But really, Jed, think about it. None of the ingredients of a Big Mac have the ability to kill themselves. Then I'd kill myself while I still could, before they came. Before who came? Whoever was going to turn me into a powerless ingredient. You're not answering the spirit of the question. I think I am, though I doubt I'll get the job. Internship. Suicide wasn't one of the options. It wasn't stated, but it was there. It's always there. And that would be your answer to the question if Maggie asked it? Well, I can't be sure, but it certainly sounds like something I'd say. She stares at me for another long moment, then slumps. Oh, nuts. It does, doesn't it? She rubs her eyes. Well, I can't argue with that. She's read your books. We're past the point of no return. Let's go ahead and try it. Mr. McKenna, may I interview you for my summer composition project?
No.
Why not?
I don't know.
But why is the answer no?
Because it's not yes.
Are you teasing me?
It sounds like I am, but I'm not. I'm treating you with respect. The answer is no because it's not yes.
So if the answer were yes, it would be yes because it's not no?
No. If the answer were yes, it would be yes because yes was indicated.
So now the answer no is indicated?
Only because yes is not indicated.
Indicated how?
I don't know.
But you know when something is indicated?
Yes.
You can't just think about it and come up with an answer on your own?
Sure. And you could put on a blindfold and go through life using a stick to find your way.
But why?
You have eyes.
I was thinking of asking my grandfather to help me with this.
I say nothing.
Him and my mom could help me come up with good questions and understand your answers.
I say nothing.
Do you think that might change your decision?
There's been no decision, just an observation.
Could it change your observation?
Of course.
Would it?
I don't know.
But the answer could be different tomorrow.
Sure.
Could it be different in 10 seconds?
Sure. 10 seconds later. Is it indicated now?
No.
Can I ask you again tomorrow?
I don't know.
She looks at me for a few seconds. We've already started, haven't we?
So it seems.
Then it must be indicated.
Must be.
May I ask what the indication is?
That we've already started.
She giggles merrily. Muchas gracias, señor.
De nada, señorita.
So, I guess I'll have some more talks with Maggie, I tell Lisa after Maggie has gone off to bed. You should always be present, and I'd like a copy of her notes in case I want them for the book. Yes, fine, of course. Thank you for being so indulgent about all this, and balanced. I'm not feeling very balanced these days.
It goes where it goes. You're aware, I'm sure, that if there's a custody battle, they'll make you out as a wacko cult broad, and you'll never see your kid unsupervised again?
Yes, she says grimly. But we're past the point of no return there, too. She gestures to our surroundings. We're already living in your compound.
Chapter 12. This sentence is false. For me, it is as though at every moment the actual world had completely lost its actuality. As though there was nothing there. As though there were no foundations for anything, or as though it escaped us. Only one thing, however, is vividly present. The constant tearing of the veil of appearances, the constant destruction of everything in construction. Nothing holds together. Everything falls apart. Eugene Ionesco.
I'm working. Lisa is fidgeting. Doing nothing isn't easy for someone who's managed to keep themselves maniacally occupied every waking minute since they started walking and talking. The effort she's applying to sitting quietly and not disturbing me is palpable. It fills the space like a throbbing hum. Without moving or making any noise, her energy is making my brain vibrate. Or maybe it's just the meds. It's mid-afternoon. We're on the pool deck at my work table. Maya is napping belly up in one of the poolside loungers. Maggie spends afternoons with friends at the public pool or in other activities. I've already had a heck of a day and was just getting settled back into my comfort zone when she sauntered along and seated herself with such a strained casualness that the effort of not wincing makes me wince. I read the same sentence 5 times before realizing there's no point. I maintain my working demeanor for a few more minutes while I enjoy her discomfort. She holds it in for a minute longer than I would have guessed she could.
I could help you with your writing, she finally says, or whatever.
I nod slightly and keep my eyes on the laptop screen. Not for payment or anything, just to be helpful, she adds. I don't respond. I minored in English, she says a minute later. I wanted to teach. I nod absently.
I'm very organized, and I'm a pretty good proofreader. Lots of experience with legal documents and correspondence.
Yeah, okay, I mutter. We'll see.
Oh, sure. Well, you know, whatever you think.
I observe her muted discomfort for another few minutes. I know what it is like to be suddenly disconnected, I could tell her. I know what it's like at the beginning, when you're cast adrift not a part of anything anymore, cut away from all the things that have always defined you. No home, no people, no place. Suddenly, everyone's a stranger. You've done unforgivable violence, committed a truly destructive act. You've lost everything through that destructive act, including much of yourself. I know the urge you're feeling to be a part of something again. I know how strong the urge is and how scary it is to be isolated and apart. This rebirth you've undergone is as reality redefining as the physical birth process. The womb you've just expelled yourself from may have been toxic and suffocating, but it was also warm and safe and familiar. And now you're in a whole different world, blindingly bright and stark, and nothing looks or works like it did before. It's cold and lonely, and everything is strange, and you can never go back. That's what I could tell her, but I don't. She hasn't asked, and it's not something I ever managed to say with appropriate solemnity. Personally, I liked the part where she is now, the severing of connections, breaking away from everyone and everything, smashing out of my old life. Yes, it was agonizing, but it was also ecstatic. I didn't have the problem Lisa has of being selective, of dumping some parts and keeping others. I was dumping the whole load. I wasn't saving myself for anything. I wasn't concerned with success because it never occurred to me that success was possible. I wasn't concerned with the rest of my life because it never occurred to me that I'd outlive my mania. I was just exhilarated and eager and experiencing my first taste of freedom. My subsequent life has just come as a pleasant afterthought. I never thought there'd be an after. My initial break was the first time I felt clean and free and self-determinable, like my life was really mine, that something other than ignorance and lies was possible. There's no nice way to do it, as Lisa has learned. It's brutal and ugly and best done quickly. No one has any idea to what degree they are shaped by the people and conditions of their environment until they undertake to extricate themselves from it. And that's what Lisa is doing now, extricating herself. Not so different from having a baby, perhaps. But the person she's pushing into the world is herself. I print out a rough draft of a chapter about flow and manifestation and integration. I slide the pages over to Lisa. Okay, counselor, you're my new temp. What do you think? She receives them eagerly and spends a few minutes reading. I guess I should tell you, she says, I'm not a New Age person. When you start talking about desire, intent, manifestation, flow, and obstruction, I really might not be your best critic. Or maybe that's why you are, I say. None of this is witchcraft or wizardry. It's just the way things work. Not just for me, for you, for everyone. You'll recognize it from your own life if you stop to think about it. There's no reason you can't comment on this material. Say whatever you want. Okay, she says. How about an example of what you're talking about how these supposed powers work in your life? Something specific. Very good, I say. The only power, though, is observation, seeing what is. So the first thing that comes to mind is this morning when I was on the bike exploring the roads out around the western end of the lake.
You know how the roads are, and you've seen the bike.
That thing up by the gate? It runs?
She has a thought and laughs. I just saw the most horrible lime green Ford Pinto parked up there. The whole roof was chopped off. The bike was a Triumph 650. I creamed it and had to buy the Pinto.
Creamed it? What does that...
For the first time, she notices the cane leaning on the table next to me and leaps up.
Oh, Jed! Jesus! What happened? What did you do? Are you okay?
She comes around the table to inspect me. She can see all the dressings on my left leg and the knee brace. She can see the dressings on my left arm, but not the ones on the shoulder and scapula, which are covered by my shirt.
Oh, my God, she says through her hands. What happened? Are you okay?
Everything is fine, I promise. I point to the pitcher of limonada. Could you please pour us some of that? It's been taunting me for the last hour. Then have a seat, and I'll answer your questions.
It looks bad, she says. Seriously, are you okay?
I'm fine, thank you. A bunch of abrasions and a jammed-up knee. Nothing serious. A little thirsty.
But you couldn't cross the room to get a drink?
She pours the drinks and sits back down, her look of wide-eyed concern still in place.
Everything's a bit seized up right now. The less I have to move, the better. This is from the motorcycle? You had an accident?
Trashed it. Yeah. Some gringo in a rental car cut me off. He was coming the other way and made his left turn across my lane right in front of me, and I had to go off the road. Airborne out of the ditch for a few seconds, and then whammo! Totaled it, except maybe the engine.
Oh, my God. How fast were you going?
I don't know. 65 or 70? Slower at impact.
Were you wearing a helmet?
No. Her hands are shaking. She's making a determined effort to stay calm.
Oh, Lord. You didn't break anything? Didn't hit your head? No concussion?
A lot of abrasions. The knee hurts, and I'm pretty sore all over. There was a lot of sliding and tumbling involved after me and the bike parted ways.
Oh, my God, she says again. Then what? Did an ambulance come?
No one came. No one even pulled over. I chimed my bells pretty good on the gas tank, so that had my complete attention. It was probably 10 minutes before I was able to take stock of the rest.
Chimed your... Oh, Mother of Jesus! Are you okay?
Fine. And that can be the last word on that. So, after a while I made some calls. My cell phone was fine. I got some kids and a pickup to come out and trade the remains of the bike and a wad of pesos for that pretty little green Pinto with no roof. You're free to use it whenever you like. Keys are in it.
I'll turn some heads in that. Have you seen a doctor?
I went to the clinic. I have to go back every day for the dressings. It's a little tricky. Just for a week or so. I'm a quick healer. Anyway, that's the answer to your question. You asked for an example of this integrated, co-creative relationship with the universe, and this accident is a very good example. Such a good example, in fact, that I'm only now beginning to see it.
I was thinking just the opposite, she says. Obviously, you don't want to crash on your motorcycle. Obviously, you don't want to have all these injuries.
No, that's true. That's where the surrender part comes in.
Surrender is of the essence of this relationship I'm describing.
You're right. My personal preference would be not to crash and get all banged up. But my preferences
don't really factor in. I have one overarching preference, and that is whatever the universe prefers. I don't have to like it or understand it, though I usually do. This little accident I had is nothing. It's just the way the universe communicates. Loud enough to be heard, and no louder. "And what would the message be?" she asks skeptically. In the very first instant of the accident, in the first second, I knew it wasn't a serious situation. I knew it immediately, faster than thought. Despite the fact that I was wickedly out of control and the next few seconds looked gravely unpleasant, I knew I wouldn't be killed or even badly injured. "You don't call that badly injured?" she indicates my injuries. "For crashing a motorcycle at 70 miles an hour? No, I call this a little tickle. Nothing broken. I didn't even scratch my head." "It's nice you can be so philosophical about it," she says. "In the sense you mean, I'm philosophical about everything." She takes her seat, but remains very stiff. "But how could you possibly know it wouldn't be serious?" "Because it wouldn't make sense. This isn't a time for change. I knew it wasn't my time to die because the third book wasn't finished. I knew I wasn't going to be injured because there would be no point in that. Why would it happen? There's no reason for it. There are no lessons for me to learn, no karma to burn, no brownie points to earn." That's a long way of saying what I understood in that first second. Getting run off the road and knowing nothing serious was happening was practically in the same instant.
"You thought all that in an instant?"
"No, I knew it in an instant. I never bothered thinking it through or verbalizing it until now. It all sounds kind of dumb now, but it was perfectly clear at the time." She looks perplexed. It's a topic that interests me and might be of practical value to her, so I try to do a better job of explaining. "Thought is an unnecessary step. We can know things directly, instantly, without any need for thinking, at which the very best of us are comically inept. Why insist on converting knowledge out of its native format into bite-sized pieces our little brains can chew on? It's just another way we seek to bring the universe down to our size instead of expanding to our rightful dimensions."
"You're saying you don't think?"
"If something needs thinking about, then I talk it out or write it out, externalize it. But that only happens with regard to the books, which have to be written out anyway. I mean, I'd have to think about it, but I don't think I think about anything else." She's giving me a very dubious look, which I kind of understand but mostly don't. I notice my mouth stays open when I'm not talking and wonder if that is a side effect of the pills. "I know this is all pretty foreign to you," I say, "but it's just business as usual to me. This motorcycle thing is a somewhat dramatic example, but operating in the flow this way, moving with patterns, seeing the larger picture, this is how I function in all areas of my life. I'm pretty good at it, actually. Still learning, though, still figuring things out. I am only an egg." She doesn't pick up on the reference. I wonder if the drugs are making my brain a bit wobblier than usual.
"But how?" she asks dubiously. "Really? How could you have known all that?"
"Because everything works a certain way, and I see how it works. There's no mystery. There's never a mistake, never a violation. These rules aren't meant to be broken. The dream state is very orderly.
There is no randomness, no chaos. The idea of a serious accident, that I would get hit by a car and get hurt or die, I can't explain to you how impossible that would have been.
Impossible?
No, not impossible. There's no right word. I have no lexicon for my way of being. It wouldn't make sense. It would be in violation. There's no better way to say it. It just wouldn't happen.
But these things do happen, she protests. People get hurt and die all the time. They die tragically, prematurely, in accidents, in fires, from violence and disease.
Do they?
Of course they do.
Wrongness is in the eye of the beholder.
Huh? What does that mean?
Rabindranath Tagore said. Rabindra who? Rabindranath Tagore, mystic poet. He said we read the world wrong and say that it deceives us.
That's true, but it's not necessarily true.
We don't have to read the world wrong. I don't read it wrong. And it doesn't deceive me.
Meaning?
We can read the world right. It's not that difficult. We can stop seeing randomness and chaos where there is order. We can stop seeing mystery where there are clearly defined patterns and inviolable laws. We can open our eyes and see where we are and how it works and how we work in it. With it. I know you don't see it yet, but it's certainly there to be seen, and you're certainly able. Nothing is hidden. I don't know how I came out of that accident okay. I'm not a great rider. But I knew that whatever was happening wasn't death or injury or even much of a nuisance, because that would be not right. That's how I knew. That's the point of the story. Things don't just happen. Everything makes sense once you see at the level of patterns. Everything flows naturally from the thing before into the thing after. Nothing is ever just random or chaotic or happenstance. That would be, to me, utterly preposterous. It wouldn't even make for amusing fiction. What the unawake person sees in brief glimpses, few and far between, the awake person sees at all times and in all things. To be asleep is to detect this ocean of being once in a while and to create superstitious explanations about invisible scorekeepers and string pullers, of gods and karma, of luck and fate and destiny. Even with eyes closed, we are able to sense the motions and currents and majesty of this energetic ocean in which we abide. To be awake is to behold this ocean of being and not to imagine ourselves apart from it. There is nothing more mystical or spiritual than to see this ocean and to live in harmony with it. There is no other freedom than to cast off egoic restraints and live in accord with what is. Lisa wants to know how I knew my motorcycle crash wouldn't be bad. If she and I sat on a beach and watched the waves roll in for an hour, I tell her, she'd probably have a pretty good idea of what the next wave was going to do, and, just as importantly, what it wasn't going to do. It's not going to suddenly freeze or reverse its course or disappear, I say. It's not going to turn into a band of mariachis and stroll up the beach to serenade us. It's not going to develop an egoic urge to express its individuality by spouting like a geyser. Obviously, says Lisa dryly.
Yes, I agree. And the patterns in which we move are just as obvious once we learn to see them. We are always in them, a part of them, inseparable from them. It's all energy,
consciousness. There is nothing else.
You're waxing very poetic, she says. Stop this day and night with me, and you shall possess the origin of all palms.
She sits and watches me for a few moments. I hold her gaze.
I remember that, she says quietly. That's by Walt Whitman. It's the first poem in your first book.
Nisargadatta Maharaj said,
Nisarga who?
Indian sage. He said, in my world, nothing ever goes wrong. That's an eyes-open statement. It's not his world that's different. It's him, his undistorted, unfiltered perspective. He has removed the artificial barrier of ego from the perceiver, perception, perceived union, and so the three become one, and perfection is the certain result.
So this Indian guy was enlightened?
Yeah, but we're not talking about enlightened. We're talking about awake. You're waking up. You can stay where you are now, groggy and confused, as many people who make it this far do. Or you can push on, continue what you've started. This stuff I'm telling you is like the coming attractions reel.
So it's all just one big ocean, is what you're saying?
Here's another good one. Carl Sagan said if you want to make an apple pie from scratch, you must first create the universe.
Meaning?
Say we're on that beach watching the waves roll in, I tell her. You look out into the distance and see the first hints of a swell. As you watch, it comes toward you and grows and grows, and finally, in its turn, it rolls and breaks and crashes and foams up onto the sand and gently recedes, making way for the next. You watch that, and the appearance is that you've seen a complete wave from start to finish, from birth to death. But that's the smallest, most limited possible perspective to take. That's what we see when we chop everything into tiny little pieces, when we put up walls everywhere and slap labels on everything, as ego insists on doing. Beginnings and endings are not known to us, only patterns. That wave you isolated began where the universe began and ends where the universe ends. As you sever attachments and stop squandering your emotional energy, your perspective broadens, and you come to see larger and larger patterns at work. Patterns within patterns, your own patterns swirling in among them, in no way separate or apart, in no way greater or lesser. You back away from that single wave, and you see tides and thermodynamics. Back away further, and you see global currents and lunar influences. Back away further, and you see planetary and solar and historical influences, and so on. Back away further, beyond your notions of time and space. And only now do you begin to see that wave, to know it, and to know as a living reality that the wave is you, and you are the wave. She sighs and looks at me in exasperation. Oneness and unity aren't profound feelings or spiritual beliefs or altered states of consciousness. They're just plain old consciousness, unadorned, uncorrupted, uncontaminated. We don't have to attend lectures or read books or kneel before altars and wise men. We need only cleanse our perceptual faculties, rid ourselves of all egoic befuddlement, see what is and stop seeing what's not. No teaching or teacher or path or practice required, just simple honesty.
I'm not sure I'm getting it, she says. Well, you will, I think. Here's a little exercise. I can't write down the notes from this conversation because my brain is doing a weird, pulsing, buzzing thing. So I'm going to hit the head and go settle into one of those lounge chairs by the pool while you write out the notes from everything we've just talked about.
I don't think I can, she says.
You minored in English, I say as I struggle to my feet. You wanted to be a teacher.
But I don't really understand any of it, she protests.
Understand it later. Write it down now, I say as I begin my pathetic journey. You asked for this. You think being an editorial assistant to a mighty spiritual personage is all candlelight and pretty life lessons? This is a place where heads come loose. She grins like I'm kidding and gets to work. Chapter 13. All is Truth.
Oh, me, man of slack faith so long, standing aloof, denying portions so long, only aware today of compact, all-diffused truth, discovering today there is no lie or form of lie, and can be none, but grows as inevitably upon itself as the truth does upon itself, or as any law of the earth or any natural production of the earth does. This is curious, and may not be realized immediately, but it must be realized. I feel in myself that I represent falsehoods equally within the rest, and that the universe does. Where has failed a perfect return, indifferent of lies or the truth? Is it upon the ground? Or in water, or fire, or in the spirit of man, or in the meat and blood, meditating among liars and retreating sternly into myself, I see that there are really no liars or lies after all. And nothing fails its perfect return, and that what are called lies are perfect returns. And that each thing exactly represents itself and what has preceded it, and that the truth includes all and is compact, just as much as space is compact, and that there is no flaw or vacuum in the amount of the truth, but that all is truth without exception. And henceforth, I will go celebrating anything I see or am, and sing, and laugh, and deny nothing. Walt Whitman.